and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. How are you, sad cogs in the big machine, filled up people from the big weekend? How you doing? Feeling fat? Are you feeling fat today? Are you? I am. It's disgusting. Mark Riley is going to be out this week because big things are happening here at Air America, and he needs to take a break for a week to get ready to retool to enter the world of the new big things, my friends. I'll explain that all to you as the show progresses, because I'm sure you're curious, and I will definitely explain it to you. I had a pretty nice Thanksgiving weekend. It was really nice. You know, I have to be grateful. I have to look back on it. It's weird. I went down to Florida. I cooked for 11 people. I made a turkey. I made stuffing. I made sweet potatoes. I did the whole thing. But, you know, sometimes I don't even realize what Thanksgiving is really about. What's it supposed to be about? I just make a bunch of food, and I give it to my family, and I expect to be applauded for the food. That's what I do. I'm like, how was the food? It was good, right? I made it. That's because that's why it was good, because I made it. And then I just eat all of the food for 3 days. And I'll be honest with you, I went on a turkey bender. That's right, people. I was a vegetarian no longer. I went on a turkey bender. Do not feel great about it. Did not eat other meat. Did not, go out in the middle of the night and have McNuggets or a hamburger or a cheeseburger. I didn't do that, but I did eat turkey for 3 days. And I got to be honest with you, I'm done with it. I'm over it. It's over. I don't want to eat any more turkey. I made turkey salad. I made turkey pancakes. I made a turkey cake by day three and iced it with sweet potatoes, which was interesting. But I don't know. It just kept happening. And well, what was I saying? So I cooked for all my family. And you know what's sad, man? You know, whatever I'm going to say, you know, a lot, because I do that sometimes, you know, when I'm sitting here flying solo and thinking about my life. I had this moment down in Florida where I realized, you know what, my parents are my mother is getting older. Her boyfriend John is, who's annoying but a very genuinely nice guy, and he knows he's annoying, but my mother's annoying too. You know, you make all these judgments about your family. But they're it. That's all you have. The one thing I noticed when I was down there is that this is my family. I can't avoid it anymore. And it's not that I was avoiding it, but I don't see them enough. And I was actually at these moments that were kind of poetic and nice where I'm like, hey, I'm not young either anymore. At some point, you got to realize, Jesus, I'm not a kid. Look at me. I'm a 42-year-old man who's sitting around obsessing about eating butter and turkey and getting fatter. And my family's right here in front of me. I got to get out of myself and reach out and talk to my cousins and start to accept this. I have a very hard time with that, because the one thing I realized about these holidays is that you sit there with your family, and not only do you notice how good they are, if you're lucky, you realize all the shortcomings they have, and you got to get past that. I don't know. Am I being overly nostalgic?
I was thinking the same thing this weekend.
Are you serious?
It's so funny that you say that.
There was a touching moment where you're like, I got to let go of this childish attitude,
right,
and start to realize, like, this is the family I have. They're good people, and I have to stop judging them, and I have to just accept that I'm just as screwed up as they are.
But it's only good for the 4 days or whatever it is for Thanksgiving.
Oh, dude, yesterday.
By the end of it,
I need to get out.
My God.
You know, you're getting on the plane with more turkey that's dry now, and for some reason it's awful. It is Brendan McDonald's, Brendan P.W. McDonald's, the recently married Brendan P.W. McDonald's birthday today. He's 26 years old. Do we sing? What do we do?
No, don't sing.
No,
we have to pay for that.
I tell you, put no publicity into your birthday. Most selfish people like myself or Dan Pashman 3 weeks ago would be like, it's coming. You ready? It's coming. Prepare yourselves to buy presents, my friends.
And I was forced to bring those cupcakes in so that you guys would know that it's my birthday. Because I had that conversation last night.
With your wife?
She said, what are the guys doing for your birthday? I said, I don't think they even know it's my birthday.
That's right. We don't know.
She was like, that's crazy. What, you didn't tell them? You didn't say this a week ago?
So she got out of bed and made cupcakes. You bring them in, yeah, and you make them feel guilty for not looking into this. You bring those cupcakes. Those are guilt cakes. Little iced guilt cakes. You didn't know it was my birthday? Well, here it is. What'd you do? Nothing, because you didn't even find out it was my birthday. Jesse wrote me a nice one. That's Jesse, who works on the Rachel Maddow show. Hey, well, I guess I might as well just tell people that I want to do it with the appropriate amount of sadness, but I can't because there's 2 more weeks of this show to go. But the struggle, the fight for Morning Sedition has been lost. You know, I certainly... God, stop saying you know, man. What, you're only going to be on radio two more weeks? Hey, look. The bottom line is all the emails were amazing. They had a lot of impact on me. They had a lot of impact on the guys who do the show. They had a lot of impact on everyone who is involved with this thing. Yeah, I was really touched by most of the emails. Another thing I didn't realize in being away for Thanksgiving and thinking about this was that when we came on the air, when I got on the show, all I wanted to do, you know, I called up Janine Garofalo. I was sitting in my garage in Los Angeles, and I said, look, you know, I need to be part of this. I want to be part of this. I want to try and take this guy down. I want to try and change the country. I want to get rid of Bush. I want to get rid of all this crap. That was my only intention. And I got on here, and I learned a whole new set of skills. I met a whole group of guys, a lot of creative people. We've done a lot of amazing work on this show, and it's been just a tremendous ride for me. And I realize when I read the emails that some people out there were so sad, so despairing, and so in a dark place after the elections last year that they really relied on this. And I didn't really take that into mind because I was so set on keeping my own head above water and getting to certain truths and trying to change things in the country and in the culture and the state of mind of everybody who listened, that I didn't really realize how much everyone appreciated what we were doing here and how comedy is so important to the process of overcoming a certain amount of fear and pain and desperation, that comedy really made people's mornings and really it was the difference between them having a crappy day and being filled with despair and them looking at it a little differently. And when I started to read those emails, it really moved me, but it wasn't enough to save our show. They are offering me to do a show in Los Angeles at night for an hour or two, and we're negotiating that. That is the deal that is going on now. But Morning Sedition will be a no longer after December 15th, I guess, is my last day. And the comedy will be gone. The scripted comedy will be gone. What's going to be here now, Mark Riley, who a lot of people are wondering, you know, why isn't he, you know, chiming in when Mark is complaining about the future of his show? Well, you know, Mark was just, you know, laying back and let me have my own feelings because his job wasn't at stake. He's going to be here, from 5 to 7 on weekday mornings and Rachel is going to be on from 7 to 9. I don't know what those shows are going to be called or what structure they are going to be in. All I know is I will not be here and Morning Sedition will not be here. What I do know is that, you know, you guys have a couple more weeks with us. And if you want to hear any of the interviews that we had over the last couple of years or any of your favorite bits or any moments you'd like us to play over the next week or two, particularly when Riley gets back, we'll start to do more of that. But please let us know at Sedition at Air America. What is it? Sedition@AirAmericaRadio.com. And let us know what moments you'd like to hear again or any specific comedy bits that blew you away and you like to revisit, because I'd like this to be somewhat of a New Orleans funeral, given that I have 2 weeks to do this and I'm sort of saturated with a type of fear and depression that is common in show business when you're making a transition. But it's been a great run, and we, as I said, we got a couple more weeks, and let's try to have a good time. So send in your requests, and let's get into a little news. And we're going to talk to Cindy Sheehan in a little while. Is going to be on the show. James Walcott will be here to discuss culture and politics and parade coverage, perhaps. And Margaret Brown, the director of Be Here to Love Me, which is a very intense and somewhat sad documentary on the great songwriter Townes Van Zandt. We'll be here later in the show to discuss him and his music and her new film. So stick around. It's going to be a light show, and I'll try and keep it together. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
You're a Democrat, Republican, or independent, you should want a fair election.
That's right.
Why is it that you don't want people to come in and monitor ours?
Congresswoman Brown, can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Are you in the tub?
I'm not going to tell you.
Congresswoman, let me ask you this. By the way,
I didn't know this was an X-rated show.
Oh, Lord.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
That's right. 20 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Edition program. I'm Mark Maron. Mark Riley is out for the week. That was Congresswoman Corrine Brown in the bathtub. That was an amazing moment because it was one of those moments where we're sitting there talking to her and you just heard this water splash into the background. And finally, you just had to ask her, are you in the tub? And indeed she was. Chris Lopresto, Kalo, where'd you go for Thanksgiving? Let's talk about it.
I went to my brother's girlfriend.
All right, good story. Moving on. Go ahead, tell me what happened. What happened? Come on, I'm serious.
Nothing. Just my brother's girlfriend's family's house.
And that was nice. What'd you eat? Turkey?
It was catered.
It was catered.
Yeah. They had servants.
No, get out of here.
It was in Long Island. Wait,
did they even call them servants? Who calls them servants? Aren't they household help? What are they called now?
Johnson.
There was a woman my mother brought into. To clean up, but we at least cooked everything. I don't like the brought in food. It takes a soul out of it. So wait, well, I was trying to lead you in cleverly into the other story that you teased during the break.
This story isn't even good for radio. This is a really bad story.
Well, you know what? It's like this isn't radio anymore. This isn't progressive radio. This is just us. We're sharing stories. Okay. We've got a week of this, Kayla. We've got a week or two. We got a week before Riley comes back, and then next week I don't even know how sad that's going to be, given that the show's over. So why don't you just tell your sad, stupid story and let's get on with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Sunday.
Yeah.
About 8:30 in the morning.
Okay.
My ex-girlfriend rings my bell.
Oh, it's already good. How's this a bad story?
And I'm like, hello?
Yeah.
And she's like, hey, Chris, sorry to bother you, but, could you open the door?
Yeah.
We need to talk. I'm like, okay. So my dog's barking and everything. I open the door. My dog runs out.
Yeah.
And my ex-girlfriend, she's like, yeah, I'm taking the dog. Bye. And like, excuse me? Like, yeah, I'm taking the dog. And she goes to leave with the dog. And I'm like, get the F out of my face. I yanked the dog away from her.
Oh,
and
poor dog.
She throws her cell phone at me.
Yeah.
It hits me in the hand. Yeah. I close the door. She starts pounding on my desk. On the door,
yeah.
Ringing my doorbell nonstop.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to call the cops.
Oh, man.
So I call the cops. I tell her that I called the cops. And she's like, fine. I'm going to tell them my ex-boyfriend just hit me.
What?
Yeah.
What? And what happened? Did the cops come?
The cops came, but apparently she left before they could...
God, you're just like those people on those shows.
I know! I'm like, Trash!
But what about the dog?
I have poor dog. It's my dog.
That dog's gonna end up in therapy.
I don't get this though. This was Chris's dog. How did this happen?
Because I took the very last of my possessions from her.
Yeah,
like she had like a side table of mine, and she was just pissed. So
well, that dog's gonna end up having trouble in school.
Yeah,
drug problems. You know, all the other kids.
No.
Oh man.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, that's my wife was with me down in Florida, and we had a lovely time. They got everyone got to know my wife a little more. Saw my cousins, and I didn't have any real problems. There were no big fights. I don't know why I'm just saying that right away, but I just want to say to my mother, who I know is listening, that I love you, Mom, and everything's turning around. I think it's going to be okay. How's that? Huh? Pretty nice. And John, my mother's boyfriend, look, I think we can tolerate each other as time goes on. I think everything's going to be okay. It's going to be ba-ba-boo. Well, yeah. You know what's interesting about Florida is you know, what's interesting about people is that there is a slight... What am I trying to say? Have you got the person in your family that all of a sudden you realize, like, oh, my God, you're just a racist person?
Yeah.
That the way they sort of condescend or talk down to...
I had someone remark at the... I'm not going to say who.
They might be listening.
That remarked at the television on the Thanksgiving Day parade, there was a Sesame Street float.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, look, that color girl's still on the show. And this is a man of 50. Not an elderly person.
Well, it's weird. Not even when that word was in use. I mean, you kind of remember that use. Oh, there's such a condescension. They don't think that... They're being racist, but they're being totally racist. My mother is not, but there was a few people in and around that were sort of like, well, them and the Schwarzes. That word. What do they? Why do they think that is okay?
Explain for a goy in the room here. What is
it? Well, that is the Yiddish word for black people, and it's derogatory and it's racist. But they, for some reason, they think it's okay. Oh, the Schwarz is a, it's not okay. It's not a good word. I don't know where they think it's okay. And then there's another issue with Latino people who are all Mexican, of course, to them, or Cuban. And I don't, it was very uncomfortable, but you can't make those arguments because they don't see themselves as racist. And you really have to go out of your way to sort of make a point and say, you can't judge everybody based on that, you know, on their driving or on whatever. But I found it disconcerting. And one guy that they set me up to talk to, this guy, Bert, some friend of theirs, who was a Republican Jew, a right-wing Jew.
An old guy, that's always the worst. You get those
old
Florida
guys. Yeah, but he sat me down, and, you know, he wanted to do the thing. He's like, well, you get paid to do this. And we had this fairly reasonable conversation until he said, I think the Republicans are making a mistake on the abortion issue because they don't know that literally millions of blacks and Mexicans are aborted every year. He was trying to make this eugenics case. And I was like, what are you, crazy? You can't say that. Those aren't the numbers even right. And why would you even promote that kind of talk? And he just sat there smugly and said that. And it's not even based in any reality. I had to go.
But do you see what you did? Is that when you had the civilized conversation with the guy, those people are not civil by nature because that part of them is in their core. Like, you just kill all the blacks and the Mexicans and the Jews and we'd be fine.
Yeah, but then he'd have to kill himself. See, it was weird that he didn't deal with those issues. We primarily talked about Iraq and the economy. And the economy is not my strong suit. In Iraq, you know, I know somewhat of what's going on because I deal with it every day. And we were able to meet sort of halfway on certain things. And I thought we were having a decent conversation. Then, bam, comes the eugenics argument.
Oh.
And I was like, what the hell just happened there? And that's one of those things where you're sort of like, you know, I gotta go because I don't want to end up, you know, yelling at an old man. Unless it's my dad. So we got Happy Thanksgiving to you, Dad, too. The holiday season was not so great for a couple of people at the Thanksgiving Day Parade. Did you see that footage of that woman getting hit? As you probably know, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, an M&M float got tangled up in a light pole and pulled the fixture off, and it fell on a family, bouncing off the tray of one sister's wheelchair and then hitting the other sister in the head, gashing her head open, and she needed 9 stitches. And if you're like, here's the interesting thing. If you're like me, you didn't see it till later in the day, if not the day after. The scary thing is, Matt Lauer didn't either. Did not see it until later that afternoon, and he was hosting the parade. We'll talk about that in just a second, and also about some monorails hitting each other. Did you go on the monorail, Chris, in Seattle?
No, I didn't.
All right, well, then maybe we'll talk about it. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Sir, there's nothing on earth like a genuine, bona fide, electrified six-car monorail. What'd I say?
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
That's right, monorail.
Monorail. Monorail. Monorail.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It flies as softly as a cloud.
Is there a chance the trap could bend?
Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
What about us Brendan slobs?
You'll be given cushy jobs.
Were you sent here by the devil?
No, good sir, I'm on the level.
The ring came off my pudding can.
Take my penknife, my good man. I swear it's Springfield's only choice. Throw up your hands and raise your voice.
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
Once again.
Monorail.
34 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. Mark Riley is out for the week. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, people. It's Monday. It's a Monday after Thanksgiving. Not a big news day for me. I'm going to be hanging out doing what I do here on the radio with my friends, if that's okay, for our last couple of weeks. For those of you just tuning in, the struggle has been lost for Morning Sedition. Morning Sedition will be no more as of December 15th. I am heartbroken about it, but I am in negotiations to try to develop a show out in Los Angeles with Air America. We'll see what happens with that. Don't despair. Mark Riley will remain 5 to 7, I guess, and Rachel Maddow from 7 to 9. I don't know what those shows are going to be or what they're going to be called, but that's the breakfast lineup for you from here on out. There will be no more scripted comedy bits. Jim Murrell will not be here, and there will be no more of the characters that you grew to love on Morning Sedition, but you will have the information that you need that will make some people happy, that will make some people sad. I'm already getting emails about how people are sad. And look, you know, I'm sad too, and we're not going to make it a sad couple of weeks. I was just told to start announcing this and getting the word out there that this is what is happening. Hopefully I'll be able to work something out with Air America, but I'll tell you, no matter where I am, I'll let you know. If you want to go to markmaron.com and put your name on my mailing list, you can do that, but don't do it. Don't write me an email saying how bad my website looks. I know it needs work, and I'll try to get to work on that. So, yeah, I just haven't had time, you know. I've been up all night doing homework for the show, so maybe when I have a couple weeks after the 15th, I'll get that website back in order. But you can sign up for my mailing list, which I eventually will start using. The Seattle monorail that connects downtown Seattle and the Space Needle had a little accident when one car going one way clipped the door of another car going the other way on a curve and ripped the door off. This is one of those things where I can't imagine being a tourist, you know, standing on this thing going, wow, look at the Space Needle. That's so pretty. Oh my God, that car's, you know, and then just glass and everything all over the place, and you gotta explain to the kids why it's not fun anymore, and then that kid's gonna be scared of trains for the rest of his life, and the Space Needle is going to represent something bad to them, and there's always going to be that weird memory of what happened in Seattle. It's, you know, it ruins lives, people, when these accidents happen. But no one was hurt. Glass shattered all over the place, and the monorail has been around since, like, the World's Fair in the Seattle, of course, 1962. It was closed down, I guess, last year for 6 months after a fire stranded 100 riders. That's another thing, getting stranded on something. Horrifying. In New Mexico, where I grew up, you know, my wife grew up in Seattle, and I asked her if she'd been on the monorail, and she's like, of course I've been on the monorail. But you never, if you live in that city, you never go on those things.
It's the worst monorail ever.
Is it? Well, I mean, it's antique, no, clearly. I mean, but what? Who else has a monorail? They just built one.
Orlando does.
To Kennedy Airport, I think. There's a monorail going out to Kennedy, isn't it, kind of?
Well, the AirTrain, yeah.
Well, what the hell is the difference? Because it's not a ride?
No, it has two tracks. It's not, you know, one rail.
Well, you call me stupid. I know what a monorail is. I just didn't know that the AirTrain had two tracks. If you drive under it, it looks like a monorail.
Newark Airport has
it goes from terminal to terminal, but the one going over to JFK. Let's not talk about it. What I want to talk about right now is tourist attractions in your hometown that you never go to unless you have guests in town. Where I grew up in New Mexico, they had the tramway. The tramway is this 2-mile-long suspended cable car that you go up to the top of Sandia Peak on the tram. And when people come from out of town, you go, let's go on the tram. And you go up on the tram. One day it gets stuck in the middle of this thing, dangling over a mountain. One of these cable cars, like 30 people are stuck in there for like 3 days. 3 days.
Wow.
Could you imagine that? What an embarrassing, just to transcend the first, like, who's going to poo first? You know, when is that, you know, how are we going to handle this? Who's going to cover? It's horrifying to me. And apparently they were square dancing and eventually became very close. I guess maybe they meet once a year just to, I don't know.
They were square dancing in the tram?
Yeah,
is
I mean,
that
just
big?
A pastime. Well, it's big enough. It's not like a sit-down tram. It's a big tram. It holds like 30 or 40 people.
Do you
it's
think
huge.
They ever had to have that conversation about, you know, if we don't get saved, you can eat my ass?
Oh, yeah. Come on! Yay! Good morning!
No, I didn't mean it in a bad... I meant like those guys in the Andes, you know, like the planes that crash have to eat the other guy's flesh.
I thought you were talking about maybe a... Hey, look, there's not much time. I've always had this fantasy.
No, like alive. Like that movie.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
There were two guys in the corner from, going like, well, you know, Jim, he looks kind of happy.
I know, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know if that would have happened. That was really a rough movie, wasn't it? The Andes, the
camera. Alive, yeah.
Here's another story talking, if we're going to take it right down the gutter. A flight from Orlando to Washington, D.C. was diverted to Charlotte, North Carolina when a drunk guy lit a cigarette and started peeing in the aisle. If this is... I've blacked out before in my life.
Was
my
dad
before
on the air?
Yeah, before I got sober, you know, you have these moments that you hope aren't seen like this. But could you imagine just sitting there on the train and seeing the guy going, I gotta go. And this guy didn't know where he was. He thought he was in the bathroom. I'm sure of it. When you drink enough, everything looks like a bathroom and you just don't realize it's not a bathroom until it's too late. But I hope that this is this guy's last drinking episode. I hope he gets sober after this, because what a great bottom-hitting story that was. You know what I mean? Just sort of like, you want to know what happened to me? I peed on an airplane in the aisle. and smoked a cigarette. But there was another guy a couple years ago that did even worse things.
Yeah, the airlines, though, you got to imagine that nowadays, too, especially if you get an air marshal on your plane,
yeah.
That's probably about the worst thing that you could do is to, you know, stand up and start peeing, because now...
They diverted the plane.
Yeah, or you could get shot nowadays.
Take a bullet.
For urinating?
Put that back in your pants! It's not like he was going, hey, tourists, take this plane to Cuba, or I'm going to pee on the pilot. Cuba, what's old school? What am I, like, living in 1970s? Hijackers don't do that anymore. He would have blown the plane up with his pee.
I agree with you, though. Yeah. I think that the guy had no idea where he was.
Of course,
you know,
not.
I remember it clear as day, the first bar that I ever went to,
yeah.
I would frequent it. They didn't ID or anything. So, and there was always this guy at the end of the bar. His name was Cap.
Yeah.
And we didn't know if he was a captain or if he drove his car into the drink and they called him captain or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
He just, hey, Cap, how's it going? Old as Methuselah.
Yeah.
And one day was, you know, we were in there in the evening and Cap got up and said, all right, I'll see everybody later. And he walked into the bathroom.
Yeah.
And we thought, well, maybe he's just going to spend a little time in there.
Right.
About 10 minutes later, he came out in his underwear.
Oh, no.
No clothes on. He thought he had gone home.
Yeah.
We were, oh, Cap, what are you doing?
Yeah.
you're not yeah. in your living room yet, man.
Yeah. Maybe by the end of the show, I'll tell you a little story about me. That was sort of a sad indication of the drinking problem.
Oh, dude, you have a good bottom story?
I got a couple good bottom stories, but the saddest one was the blackout story where I thought I was in the bathroom and I wasn't. And, you know, I was actually, you know, sitting on a chair in my bedroom just peeing. And my wife my wife woke up and goes, what are you doing? And I was like, what do you mean? And that was the beginning of a long conversation of, you know, you've really got to do something. You really have a problem. And I'm like, what? It happens sometimes. People pee in the living, in their bedroom because they think they're on the toilet.
So,
anyways,
so you were sitting down. So were you doing one and two?
No, Chris, no.
That would be
no. Good. No. Let me ask you a question if we're going to do this on the air. Like, when you're drunk, I mean, why stand up? Do you understand? It was one of those things. You know, who doesn't, you know, if you're at home and you're drunk, why are you going to stand up? Can I do the iNews now? I'm actually getting embarrassed the direction the show's taking. I'm getting, it's two more weeks, huh? Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. From ABC News, here we go. Yeah, Bush mourns fallen troops in radio address. Bush mourns fallen troops in radio address. Translation, Bush imagines gaining 2 pounds, forces out tears. That's one I can relate to. From CNN, holiday shopping season has flat start. Holiday shopping season has flat start. Translation, buying children's love off to slow start. Yeah, look what mommy got you. Don't you love? Okay, from Medical News Today, swimming with dolphins can alleviate depression. Swimming with dolphins can alleviate depression. Translation, swimming with dolphins in your private lagoon next to your enormous vacation home in the Caribbean can alleviate depression. That's a very good one there, because I have that moment. You know when people say to you, like, hey, look, money doesn't solve everything. You know, you could have a huge house, you could have a pool, you could have everything you want and still be unhappy. There's always that part of me that's sort of like, yeah, I wouldn't mind trying that, though. You know what I mean? Yeah, I wouldn't mind, you know, having that observation from the other side. You know, just once, you know, if we're going to talk about it.
How about out in L.A., Mark? Are there things you only take visitors to if they're in town, like attractions that you would never go to?
Dude, I wasn't in L.A. long enough to not feel like a visitor myself. I really wasn't. I mean, how long was I in? I was in L.A. for 2 years, in 6 months of it. I just never quite clicked in, but I've gone to Disneyland with my wife.
You have?
I have. I've gone to Disneyland.
Well, there are a million places like that here in New York that you wouldn't take, you wouldn't go to unless you had the out of town.
I've been to the Statue of Liberty once. I went to Ellis Island.
I've never been there.
Never?
No.
You've never been to the Statue of Liberty?
Born and raised here, never gone.
I didn't go up in it. I stood by it and said, guy, look at that line. And, you know, and then went to Ellis Island, and I went and looked at my grandfather's name, and I'm like, here he is. That's it. And then he's standing in the hall and go, God, it must have been really smelly and awful here. And then you walk around the house. But it is important. I trivialize things, but I did find it kind of moving. I would like to go up into the Statue of Liberty. I never got to do that. The Empire State Building is another great one. That's a great one. That's a beautiful old building that people go up. What else is there? Yankee Stadium. Have I been there? I don't think I've ever been to Yankee Stadium.
I like to take people to certain New York landmarks, but they're not the things that people generally go to see. You know, you go to like Poe's house up in the Bronx and stuff like that.
You went to Poe's house?
Oh, yeah.
I've never been to Poe's house. See, my father comes in town. People I know, they come in town. They're like, I want to get that soup. You know, the good soup at the place? They could go there, but usually the Second Avenue Deli, what have you. Hey, look.
I usually bring my friends to be like, hey, you guys are from out of town. See this library? That was in Ghostbusters.
Brian from Everett is on the phone. We're going to talk to him in a second. Also, have you heard about the Canadian Exopolitics Initiative to stifle the war between this world and extraterrestrials that they think they're being sucked into by the United States? Well, that's news, man. There's also some hostages in Iraq. There's serious news and funny news. 46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Fifty past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. This is Mark Maron. Mark Riley is out this week. This will be one of the last 2 weeks of Morning Sedition. I'm sorry, but I certainly appreciate the thousands of emails that came in support of this show, man. And I really was moved by so many of them. And I am so grateful to all of you for listening. And I'm so grateful that I was able to at least bring some hope into your lives. I that was the one thing that amazed me about all the emails that were coming in about Morning Sedition was like, you guys, you really got me through a dark time. You guys got us through a really miserable election and through a completely despairing and desperate, horrible, dark place. And it's so weird because I was in it too, but I guess it's just by virtue of my need to keep my head above water that I was able to provide you with some relief and also the great cast of characters and comedians and brilliant production stuff that we got going on here. Man, I'm going to miss this show. We do have two more weeks of it, though. I just want to put the information out here. Mark Riley will be continuing on from 5 to 7 every morning on the weekdays, and Rachel Maddow will pick up the 7 to 9 spot. I don't know what those shows are going to be called, if they're going to be called something different, or what the structure of those shows will be. There will be no more scripted comedy. I'll tell you, next week, not only are we going to play some great clips, there's already emails coming in with requests for the clips, but I want Pashman to come in a couple of days, you know, like at around 8, so we can all, you know, get the whole crew back together here. Minus a couple people that just aren't going to be.
It's like the
yet.
Blues Brothers,
is it?
You got to get the band back together.
I'll tell you one thing: we did some amazing stuff on here that has never really been done on radio, not in many years, anyways. In the form that we did it, in terms of scripted bits, and we never got a CD out because we never had the support from the network to really put out, like a Lawton Small CD or any of that kind of stuff. Because I don't know why it didn't happen. We tried to make it happen. Didn't happen. We got a lot of calls on the line here for this or that or the other thing. Hey, if you want to share some, I was talking earlier about Thanksgiving and about gratitude and how I was, reluctantly and begrudgingly accepting that I was grateful. I'm grateful to have the mother I do. I'm grateful that she's happy with the man she's with. I was even happy to see my uncle who causes a lot of people a lot of distress, but I was very happy to see my family. I don't always know how to show it. And I had some arguments that were political, but not really. It was more lighthearted. Did any of you have any moments over Thanksgiving? Were you able to bring any of your Republican relatives over to the other side? Did you have any realizations? I'd love to hear some because, you know, I'm looking at my life right now, and what's in the future for me is completely unknown. I don't know what's going to happen. Now, we are trying to negotiate a show for me out in L.A. on Air America there that could be syndicated here, maybe on the weekends, maybe later in the evening. But out of all this fear, I'm finding that I'm less judgmental, and I'm trying to keep my heart in the right place. If any of you had any experiences you'd like to share that would lift me up, that'd be great. 866-303-2270. Right now, I got Brian in Everett. What's up, Brian, my friend?
Yeah, I'll tell you about my Thanksgiving. I stayed home. And I'll tell you why. Yeah. It's because my uncle and aunt were in, and, you know, I'm grateful for my family in the sense that they have enough cash to keep me alive.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh,
and it's like my uncle runs this global shortwave Christian radio network that
really
has antennas in Quito, Ecuador.
I thought you were going to say in your head.
Well, that, well, if you take the right drugs, they will get it.
Yeah, I know that,
but
man.
That's a long story. But anyway, and all other things, I'm sad your show's going. And if you ever play back anything I've said on the air, I have to explain something, because this is kind of a drunken, bottom-hitting thing when I called and cursed out the person who was messing with my phone business and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
And there were a couple behaviors that I encouraged for this person to do, and I wanted to explain that. Maybe I wanted to kind of retract that, because the first one, the first behavior I requested that the person would do would be a biological oddity, or maybe a certain famous porn star from the 70s could do it.
Oh yeah, we play that one. You know, let me just tell our listeners, Brian from Everett has been calling our show for years, it seems. I mean, we've only been on the air about 18 months, but he's certainly been a regular guest on the air in different states of consciousness.
Yes.
And we use that one as a promo.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you want to apologize?
No.
Oh.
But I'm just saying the second behavior that I encourage the person to
yeah,
do
yeah.
would be, I wouldn't wish that on anyone.
Okay, well that's nice.
And then also, in your travels, and I know you're an independent speculative investigator.
I am, yeah.
Just remember, here's the clue. This is what I have for you.
Did you hear about... Okay, go ahead.
And you're talking about aliens and stuff?
Yeah, I can...
Remember this. The deranged monkey people have stolen the angel's magic.
Thank you. I will put that in the board. Thank you, Brian. Thank you for sharing with us. I'm going
to
do that story right now.
Later.
Okay, bye. So this is a true story right here. Go ahead. Do that. Do we have time to do the Brian thing? We'll do it later. The Canadians may have a good health care system, and everything seems to be a bit more at peace up there. They aren't in the war in Iraq. They allow gay marriage and medical marijuana. But right now, there is a pressing issue at hand for a former Canadian Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer, is how to deal with extraterrestrials among us and the pending confrontation between the inhabitants of this planet and whatever is out there. He claims that the U.S. has been preparing weapons to use against the aliens, and that we could get them into some intergalactic war without them even knowing it. He cites the expansion of the military operations that Bush is wanting to put a base on the moon as an indication. Basically, the Canadians, in terms of what he's saying, he's trying to get the Canadians to get in good with the aliens so they don't get sucked into an intergalactic war. This is called the Canadian Exopolitics Initiative, which is basically a plan to put forth by several organizations, and it proposes that the government of Canada undertake a decade of contact. Now, you know, I wish I had a joke at the end of this, but I'm telling you, in my current mental state, I'm like, well, it doesn't sound like a bad idea. Just, you know, hedge your bets a little bit. You know what I mean? You never know. You know, you don't want to get into bad with the, but it is the insane thing is when he presented this idea, standing ovation. What's going on in Canada that they're like, I think he's ahead of the game here. You know, they didn't go to Iraq either. Well, apparently they're not going to go to Mars or the moon or anywhere else to fight aliens because of a war that we got them into. That's our Canadian neighbors. But I still want to move there. It's 57 past. We'll take, there's a couple of interesting calls on the phone I'd like to talk to you. 57 past, Air America Radio. Good morning. It's 6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley's out for the week, resting up for what is going to be the big last week of Morning Sedition. I'm sorry, folks. I got to tell you that it's over. Morning Sedition will be no longer as of December 15th. I will be gone. The reason Mark Riley hasn't piped in and my sort of progressive whining about the state of our show is Mark Riley remains. He will be here from 5 to 7 every morning, and Rachel Maddow will be here from 7 to 9 every morning. This is the decision of the executives here at Air America Radio. This is what's going to happen. There will be no more scripted comedy. There will be no more characters that we built on this show. There will be no more interaction between me and my friends here in the booth. I will be hopefully showing up on Air America in Los Angeles for doing an evening show. If the negotiations work out, perhaps that will be syndicated here in New York. I've been told that maybe it will be on the weekend here in New York if we can get that deal working. If not, I will let you know where I'm going to be. There are other offers out there, so we'll see. MarkMaron.com. You can go there and sign up for my newsletter, which I will be writing. No complaints about the website. I don't want. I know it needs work. I haven't been able to do anything with it for a long time. So now we got a couple of calls. There was a couple of stories. It's not a huge news day today, so we're sort of laying back and we're having some fun, if that's okay. I will be talking to Cindy Sheehan in about an hour. She's out there in Crawford. I'll see what's up with her. We got Jim Walcott coming in from Vanity Fair to discuss some media. I'd like to talk to him about the fact that Katie Couric and Matt Lauer sitting there hosting the Macy's Day Thanksgiving parade. A light fixture gets tangled up in an M&M float, falls on a kid in a wheelchair, bounces off the tray in her wheelchair, hits her sister in the head, causing that girl to get six stitches in her head. Do they cover it while the parade is on? No. Are they told that it happened? No. Do they just put in a segment of last year's M&M float for no particular reason? Yes. These are reporters. Why wouldn't they cover it? You know, this is a theme of this country right now. Why buzzkill when things are going good, at least if it's a fictional thing? Here you got a parade. I mean, here's the choice one has to make. It's like a light fixture just fell on a crippled kid. Do we throw it into the parade? Like, someone made that decision not to tell Katie Couric and Matt Lauer. Somebody said, hey, I don't, you know, it's a parade. So now Matt Lauer goes home and he's got to look like a schlub as a reporter because why? Because he wasn't able to cover something that happened around the corner. Like we couldn't get past it, like it wouldn't have added another dimension to the parade, like something real being reported at that moment. Unbelievable. I'd like to talk to Walcott about that. The other thing we were talking about is a guy who made them reroute a plane that was traveling from Orlando to Washington, D.C. They had to land in North Carolina because some drunk guy started peeing in the aisle and smoking. And I, of course, had to share stories about myself knowing what it's like to be in a blackout towards the end of my drinking career and peeing on the floor. And I think I've got a witness, Mary, listening in Sicily, Italy. How are you, Mary?
I'm good. How you doing, Mark?
Good. Did you want to not make me feel so alone in my peeing in a blackout story?
Yeah, I'm going to share my story with you.
Okay.
This is about 15 years ago, and I got really bombed at some office party and went home and, you know, woke up in the morning and I was like, why does my room smell like urine? I couldn't figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
I had a really cheap shag carpet, which is like really
bad. The carpet.
Actually, I sat in the chair and peed in my expensive new desk chair, and I was peeing on my black crepe Jones New York suit, which to me was like my life at the time, you know? So then I have to take the suit to the drug cats, you know?
Damn cats. Yeah, of course it's a cat's fault, those damn cats. All right, well, thank you for sharing. That hasn't happened again, has it?
Oh, well, no, absolutely not. Or at least I don't remember if it has. So. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Hey, I have one more thing to tell you.
What, Mary?
About Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
About Thanksgiving. Last time I talked to you guys, I didn't let you know that I have a son who's a U.S. Marine, and I didn't know at the time that he was going to be going to Iraq. And last summer when Cindy was in Crawford, I sent a boatload of money down there because I just love the woman so much and I wanted to make them comfortable with some tents and some different things. And my partner at the time was very upset with me. We gave up a vacation to send money down there. But I knew it would be something was good was going to come of it. Well, it did, because Ben got sent to Iraq and he got blunted by an IED in October. But he's alive and he's out of there. And, you know, I want to say when Cindy comes on the show today that I want you to give her a special hot hands up for her. From Binka, that's what she'll probably know me as.
And Binka?
I'm just so thankful. Yeah, from Binka.
And your son's your son's okay?
He was in Germany. I went to see him there. He went to Bethesda. He's got some really nasty wounds. He probably won't walk for 6 to 8 months. But he's alive, Mark.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, and he's out of there.
Yeah.
And, like, so I'm really thankful this year. And I'm really, really sad that they're taking you off the air because you're my one connection to the States that I really love.
Oh, thanks.
So, hey, I'm going to go to your website. I'm going to give you my email address. And you and your lovely wife are welcome to come to Sicily and hang out with us.
I might take you up on that, Mary.
Hey, come on.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
Thanks for calling. I'll tell Cindy what you said. Wow, that's a powerful story. You know, I know another woman up in Boston their sons, her son, this woman I know in Boston, wanted to get into the Marines. It was something he wanted to do. His father was, you know, behind it, and his mother was definitely against it. And these kids, they make this decision for whatever reason, whether it's to test themselves, whether it's to fight for their country, whether it's to get a skill they might not have had, whether it's a personal challenge, whether it's loyalty. I don't know, but they make these decisions. And a lot of times, you know, mothers are the last ones to be able to tell them not to go or to give them advice that would make them make a different decision, and they go and things happen. You know, I'm just glad that that Mary's son is at least, you know, not dead. It sounds like he was pretty badly injured, but he's okay. And I don't know what my friend in Boston's kid is doing, whether he's over there, but it's very difficult for mothers. And I'll tell you something, and we'll talk about this a little more. Cindy Sheehan has done an amazing thing, not only in reinvigorating the anti-war movement, but by reframing it entirely and putting it into the, you know, the hearts of the American people from the point of view of a mother, from the point of view of somebody who sees the war as being senseless, as being based on lies, as being unnecessary, but also seeing it from the point of view of somebody who has taken her grief and mobilized it into a message of hope and peace and activism. And this is a new anti-war movement. You know, a lot of the Republicans say that the anti-war movement is dead, but it is certainly not dead. And the impact that Cindy Sheehan has had on this country in relation to this war and the cultural dialogue that she has instigated, you know, coupled with sort of the elevation of the truth through our network here and through a lot of blogs and through just, you know, people doing the activism and doing the research and getting the truth out there, has really created a momentum in this country to the point where you get Bush's poll ratings at an incredible low, and also just the approval of the war, despite, you know, whether people are Republican or Democrat, being incredibly low. And his commitment to it is being isolated, and it's making him look delusional. And there's a new Seymour Hersh piece coming out in the New Yorker that really shows him to be belligerent, stubborn, and uncaring about the cost of human life in this war. And his belligerence in staying there, despite the fact that people who know about war and the evidence of all evidence on the ground that it is exacerbating the situation as opposed to helping it, shows a type of lack of conscience that is horrendous. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we get closer to having Cindy Sheehan in the air. But what she has done for the anti-war movement in resurrecting it and reframing it, I mean, it's not just angry hippies anymore. What it is, it's Americans of all different they come from all different parts of the spectrum, all different parts of the class spectrum, all different parts of the political spectrum, who are really bonding around one primary element, is that our kids are dying for a lie, our kids are dying unnecessarily, and these politicians who continue to do this have to be taken to task. And this is it just the face of the anti-war movement is completely different. It was no longer, you know, tied to the nostalgia frame. It is something very real and very immediate and very pressing. And I'm grateful that she's out there, and I'm grateful we're going to have her on the show in just a little while. I guess I will come back and we'll talk a little bit about Jerry Falwell's war against people who he sees as be having a war against Christmas. It's completely delusional and ridiculous, and it's just another tactic of the religious right to divide the country. If they were really Christian, they'd be opening their arms to everybody and engaging people in an educational and tolerant process of seeing what other people do with their holidays and how other people practice and bringing them in to the fold and really sort of showing what Christmas is really about. But these people instead choose to hate out of fear of losing their power base. And we're going to get into that in just a second. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Fame, I'm going to embark on a political career, I think, just to leap off from this show.
Yeah, I think this is the beginning for you, bro.
Yeah, I have a new political party. It's called the Anti-Social Socialist Party.
That sounds good. Is it just you in it?
My slogan is, do I have to leave the house?
Oh, no. I'll vote for you, Brian.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
All right, 21 past the hour. That was a moment from our past. We're going to be doing more of those. If you'd like to request some, we're already getting requests at morning, what is it, sedition@airamericaradio.com. You can request any of our old bits because, as I said before, Morning Sedition, the struggle has been lost to save this show. I will be leaving as of, I guess what it's really going to be is December 16th will probably be our last show, as many things here. It's not completely organized, but that is the end of, they've asked me to stay on through December. I'm doing that, and then I'm taking a vacation, as a lot of people are, but December 16th, I believe, is the end of what they call the fall book in the radio business, so that will be the end of Morning Sedition. I am in negotiations with Air America Radio to do another show from Los Angeles in the evenings. Perhaps a syndicated show. There is some talk of me getting some weekend time here in New York. I don't know if that show on the weeknights will be on here in New York. I don't know if it's going to happen. But if you go to markmaron.com and sign up on my mailing list, I'll let you know whether it's going to happen. But for the time being, Morning's Edition and all the characters that come with it are going to be gone. As of December 16th, Mark Riley will be taking the 5 to 7 spot, Rachel Maddow the 7 to 9 spot. That's why you haven't heard Riley really chime in about what's happening with the future of our show, because he still has a future in the mornings here at Air America Radio, and Rachel Maddow in a better time slot. That'll be some good morning programming for you. Hopefully, I'll be on in L.A. and we'll make that happen. We'll see if those negotiations work out. Right now, somebody who will be returning to L.A. with me. Unfortunately, it's that time of week again when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
It's bad today, huh?
The show's over?
Yeah, a couple weeks. 3 weeks, I guess. 3 full weeks.
What did anybody tell me?
We're going to tell you today.
This is the first I heard of it. We've been having problems?
Yeah, a little. I'm sorry, Mort. We'll tell you after the thing. Oh, you going to be able to get through this?
This goes to show you always read the blog. you're just so out of touch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Who died?
Celebrity dwarf John Rice.
Oh, it's already horrible.
John Rice, the self-made Florida millionaire who at 2 feet 10 inches was one of the world's shortest twins, tragically died this month after falling off a 1-foot ladder.
Come on, he did not.
Yeah, he just broke every bone. Over the last 25 years, Rice and his equally small brother Greg became millionaires doing infomercials and acting in TV and film. You know, mostly shorts.
Of course. It would have to be.
No, shorts.
Yeah, of course, I get it.
Mark, as news of Rice's death spread, flags all around the state were lowered to 1/4 staff.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah,
it's really sad.
Rice's brother asked that John be remembered as the indomitable optimist who always saw every glass as less than half full.
Oh, no. Awful.
Yeah. Rice is survived by his brothers. Sneezy, dopey, grumpy, happy, and of course, Greg.
Greg, of course. Yeah.
Oh, it's God, awful. The show's really over?
Yes, it is really over.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Why don't I ever keep up with this stuff? All right. Ruth Seams, inventor of stovetop stuffing. Ruth Seams, the home economist who created stovetop stuffing and made it the most popular Thanksgiving leftover since vomit and domestic violence, died last week of a heart attack while experimenting with a vibrating turkey baster.
Oh, yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah. Stovetop stuffing was first marketed by General Foods in March 1972.
Uh-huh.
It proved to be so popular with the public that it was included on the White House enemies list.
Yeah, I read about that.
Yeah. Nixon was paranoid.
Yeah, stovetop. It's coming.
Yeah. Friends Say Seams first came up with the idea for stovetop stuffing while trying to figure out a way to make Thanksgiving even more painful. Turkey Day!
Yeah.
Easily prepared in just 5 minutes, stovetop stuffing comes in a wide range of flavors, including turkey, chicken, beef, and smelly Uncle Harold.
Oh, I haven't tried that one. They're still going to make it, right?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah.
Love that smelly Uncle Harold. According to the official United States patent description, stovetop stuffing's secret lay in the crumb size.
Yeah.
You see, if the dried bread crumb is too small, adding water to it makes it a soggy mass. Too large, and the result is gravel.
Yeah.
In other words, people pay way too much attention to this kind of crap.
I'll say.
Man.
Yeah, it's bad.
Seems requested the remains be toasted, crushed into eraser-sized lumps, and then rammed up the ass of a butterball turkey. So those cheap bastards at General Foods can finally taste the bitter revenge of a woman screwed out of 30 years of patent royalties.
Oh, justice. Yeah. Don't blow your nose, we've got a few seconds.
Sure, thanks a lot, man. At least these tissues are still free, huh?
Yeah, for now. That sounded good.
By the way, you can find out what's going to happen to Jim Earl at jimearl.org. The alternate email site, iamnocareer.net.
It's going to be all right, Jim. We're going to be all right. You'll be out there in L.A. We'll get something going. We're going to have Jim Walcott in a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about Jerry Falwell fighting the people he thinks that are fighting Jesus. It's a delusion, but it's real. Jim Walcott coming up next, 27 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here. Mark Riley on vacation this week, resting up for his new place in the mornings here on Air America Radio from 5 to 7. Rachel Maddow from 7 to 9. That's going to be happening after December 16th. Riley will be back here with me for the week after, and the week after that, I guess it's 3 weeks before Morning Sedition is officially done and over with and the new scheduling starts. We fought the good fight. And we fought it with the help of my next guest, actually, who I was just talking to about what to do with my apartment and my cats. He refuses to take a cat. Our next guest is contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants, Saluting of the News in a Time of Terror. You can check out his musings on his blog, www.jameswalcott.com. But right now, James Walcott joins us live in the studio. Good morning, Jim.
Morning. Thank you. Happy Festivus.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. It's weird, you know, you've had two cats.
Yeah,
I've got three. I'm going to have five in L.A. I tell you, I want to get rid of, not get rid of, that's wrong. I'd like to find a nice home for one cat. And every time I bring this up, I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you, how deeply into the cat community you are. Are you?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Well, every time I mention maybe finding a new nice home for one of my cats, I get a call from this woman, Fran, who helped me out when I took the cats in, saying, "You can't. You can't give away the cat. You must keep the cat forever now. You are the cat's mommy."
I know. Well, the thing is, we had three cats, and so one of ours died this year.
Sorry.
So that's one of the reasons. You know, it's like, so we're in that period of we're letting the other two sort of get used to the fact that top cat is gone. Because there's a whole hierarchical thing with cats.
I know,
it's,
and I got
a major thing.
I know, I got to bring these to L.A. These three feral cats are going to come out and meet my two house cats in L.A. And there's going to be that whole thing. I got to fly them. One of them's going to go. I can't believe I'm talking cats with Jim Walcott. Is that okay?
But
and then I've got the whole apartment issue because I got to get out of here in like 2 weeks and move my life.
Yeah.
And I got to sublet the apartment because people in New York are like, don't get rid of the apartment. My mom's boyfriend down in Florida, John the Jazz guy's like, oh, you got to keep that, baby.
Skip-a-doop-boop-bop. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. No, people feel as if once you have a piece of real estate in New York, you never give it up.
But I'm renting it, though.
Oh, I know. But it's sort of like, your name, as long as your name is on the lease.
Yeah, you keep it forever. You can actually legally sublet. Let's talk about some real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure saw that that horrendous accident where that light fixture got tangled up in the M&M float and dropped on that that kid's head after bouncing off her sister's wheelchair. And Katie Couric and Matt Lauer did not cover it. This is indicative of the way the media really works in this country. It seems to be a metaphor, is that here you got a parade, and you've got someone who's producing a parade, not a news producer, probably saying, no, we can't ruin the parade.
Well, what's odd about it is they act as if no one else is covering the parade, as if no one's going to know about it if they don't bring it up and spoil everybody's mood.
Right.
But it's sort of, I mean, I knew about it, you know, almost right after it happened, because it was brought in, you know, all of a sudden on, you know, if you were watching other cable news, they're giving you helicopter shots of this fallen balloon and the crowd. And for a moment, I thought it was a flashback. I know it's happened before in the parade, but there was also a Seinfeld episode in which I think it was Woody Woodpecker ran amok, you know? So for a moment I'm going, well, wait, is this a parody? And then I realized, oh, no, it's happened again. But, no, I mean, the funny thing is that you would almost like to know the chain of command of, like, how high did it go before somebody said, no, we can't tell Katie and Matt. It would bum them out.
And that just, it makes them look silly, and I'm sure they felt even worse when they got home.
Oh, I bet they were, I bet they were upset.
Livid, right?
I bet they were upset.
But it seems to me that is the tone of how a lot of America media works, is that here you have a news story that somebody decided was, you know, categorically, you know, maybe not important enough to ruin a parade with, but in the parade itself, and somebody makes these decisions. Apparently, this was an interesting thing. I saw them, I believe it was on the Weekend Today show, they interviewed the family. And I'm thinking they're definitely going to sue. They've got a million lawsuits. But they actually, this was a very noble thing. The father just said, it's a freak accident. We're not going to sue. Macy's gave them a bunch of presents, said they could sit up front at the parade, and they're thrilled about it.
Gee, that almost restores your faith in
humanity. But only for a minute.
Yeah, it won't last, but.
And now we have Jerry Falwell, who is mobilizing 24,000 members in his church on the Friend or Foe Christmas campaign, fighting an imaginary war against Christmas. He's fighting a war against people he thinks are fighting a war against Christmas. Now, this is a multi-leveled issue in a lot of ways, is that, you know, you've got this tree lighting ceremony in Boston. The city of Boston got a bunch of people worked up because they're calling the tree that they're lighting on the Boston Commons this year a holiday tree and not a Christmas tree, because they're afraid that if the taxpayers, whose money they're using to light the tree, get wind of the fact that it's a Christmas tree, that they're going to be, you know, taken to task for being, you know, too Christian or for crossing the line between church and state. And then you've got Jerry Falwell's people who are attacking Boston now for taking the name Christmas off it. The logger who cut the tree down thought he should pulp the tree if they weren't going to call it a Christmas tree. And the bottom line is that a Christmas tree is a Christmas tree. It doesn't matter what religion you are. It doesn't matter. We know what it is. It's a secular icon, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it has pagan origins. But, you know, one of the things I've noticed is that each year the war against the war on Christmas gets more organized and mobilized. I mean, in the past, it's been the talk show hosts. It's been Fox News. But this year, John Gibson of Fox News actually has a book timed, you know, with the season about the war on Christmas. And then on the weekend, I was switching dials, and there on Fox News, John Kasich, you know, the former congressman, he's got his own show. And now we're going to tell you in the next segment about the war on Christmas.
Yeah.
Blah, blah. So they're working up their juices to make this a cultural war thing each year. Each year it gets bigger and bigger. And part of what it is not just ramming, you know, Christianity everywhere. A lot of it is also like a way of getting at the ACLU and other groups. Because in the next breath, after they talk about, oh, the war on Christmas, it's like, the ACLU and other liberal groups want to ban the manger, and then they go into the whole thing, you know, which is part and parcel. I mean, that's what Bill O'Reilly and Gibson and the rest of them do. They're always lashing out against the ACLU. I mean, the other thing that we see every year now is more and more urban legends. I mean, a couple of years ago, the legend was the employees of Macy's have been instructed not to wish anyone a Merry Christmas, right? And then Macy's, like, panicked because they were getting boycotts. They had to put out a statement. It's like, no, we never said that. This year, it's a whole business. Somebody, a blogger, wrote about how she went to the post office, and the post office employee said, we're not allowed to wish you a Merry Christmas. but if you wish us one, we can wish one back.
That's
and so this got all picked up on, on the internet, like, oh, well, once again, the secularism.
So these are the right-wing blogs are going nuts
The right-wing blogs,
But let me ask you, it seems to me that this is just another wedge that they're putting in between, it seems that it's another moral issue that is exacerbated by the fact that the Republicans and the religious right are losing some traction culturally now because of what is going on with the war, what is going on with the administration, the lies that are coming out, and this seems to be a cultural momentum in the propaganda machine, the right wing propaganda machine, to once again demonize liberals, to create some straw men, and to just galvanize that base and get them angry over nothing. Because the bottom line is, I mean, Christmas trees are permitted in public schools; they are considered secular symbols. Nativity scenes are allowed on public property if the government is paying for it, then they have to represent other religions in whatever's being depicted on the public property. And the ACLU, more so than not, is going to defend whoever's being unjustly treated. It's not, and they have defended Christians handing out pamphlets in schools and their First Amendment rights, and they've defended both sides of this. So this, to me, just seems like a way to get the religious right stoked up.
Well, yeah, they do feel that the morale is flagging. You know, because in part it's because Bush's own fortunes. Bush incarnated the religious right and there's newfound sense of power.
Right.
And now Bush's shrinking. He's sort of diminishing before our eyes because we now realize that between the two of them, Karl Rove and Dick Cheney are actually running things.
Everyone knew that. That's the weird thing that I noticed, too, is that Republicans knew that going in, and they realize what's happening now as well. They realize that once Cheney started to be revealed for what he was and Karl Rove became revealed for what he was, they knew that Bush was powerless, and now they can't even get behind him. They just feel sorry for him.
Yeah, and you know, we used to laugh. I mean, some of us used to laugh when they used to run those pictures of Bush framed with a halo around him.
Yeah.
But in fact, a lot of people in this country on the religious right, they did take Bush as sort of like a religious figure as well as a political figure. And now that he's sort of fading, it's like, oh, well, we've got to do something to get them back up. Because what they're terrified of politically, of course, is that all of those people will stay home during the midterm elections.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like, no, we got to get something out to work them all up. I don't think the Christmas thing's going to do it because for one thing, it'll after Christmas it ends, so they've got to find another thing.
But it seems to me that I don't know at what point that Christians, whether they're fanatic Christians, whether they're extreme whack job Christians, or whether they're just relatively sane Christians, where do they draw a line and say, look, Christmas time? Like, I'm a Jew. I grew up with Christmas around me. I didn't feel alienated by it. It was a little weird when I'd go over to people's houses, but it was usually weird because they were weird. They're like, the Jews here. You know, how do we treat the Jew on Christmas? I mean, they were more uncomfortable than I was. But where was I going with this? Is that when do Christians start to behave like Christians? I mean, the holiday period is a time to reach out. It's a time to be charitable. It's a time to be tolerant and all inclusive, and I don't know why we can't be proud in this country of having a culture made up of a diverse, different types of people that embrace all different types of religions and can all sit at the same table. And at least, why not educate the kids about that? Isn't that a Christian principle to reach out?
Well, I actually think a lot of Christians don't have that big a problem with it. I think it's their demagogic leaders. I mean, I think with Jerry Falwell, I think this is just an excuse to get his face on TV.
His dumb face back out in the world.
His dumb face. He loves being on TV.
Yeah.
He'll be on TV from now through this, the whole season talking about it. I'm sure he'll be bringing us updates. Well, we've learned. This is a very disturbing thing. We've learned that, AMCO.
Yeah. I've talked to Jesus, and Jesus will not shop at Target if they insist on not using his name.
They will not replace your muffler with, with a Merry Christmas. I mean, no, that's what we're going to get. But, the fact is people know that Happy Holidays and Merry Christmas are interchangeable, and that if you say one rather than the other, you're not making a statement.
It's interesting to me, too, that a lot of Christians, over the period of American Christianity and over the history of Christianity, have thought that the Christmas tree was a pagan representation of a different God, and that they were against it, and that apparently it wasn't even introduced into this culture until like the mid-1700s, I think, by Germans. The Christmas tree tradition dates back to Western Germany in 16th century. They were brought into homes to celebrate the Feast of Adam and Eve on December December 21st. First brought to America by German immigrants in 1700, Christmas trees became popular among the general population by 1850. Mm-hmm. So this is a fairly new sort of tradition. Well, it wasn't even connected to Jesus.
Well, that's like the way that a lot of people say that the, you know, the true inventor of Christmas was Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
That if it weren't for Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol, our whole sense of Christmas would be totally different than it is now.
I can tell you, as a liberal person and a progressive person, no liberal I know is trying to deny anybody their holiday season. And it's really about being a little more inclusive, reaching out, being a little more charitable. The Christmas tree, I don't know anybody that's offended, whether you call it a Christmas tree or a holiday tree or a Hanukkah mm-hmm. bush. What the hell difference does it make? What else is on your radar? Anything pressing, Jim?
Well, I'm just sort of interested in seeing where all these different investigations go. I mean,
God, it's so exciting.
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I think the one we really
Hey Jim, let's hold it.
Oh, sure.
And why don't you hang out and we'll talk Abramoff, we'll talk Leak, because I think Abramoff's going to bring everyone down.
It's going to be juicy.
All right, well, let's speculate in a second. I'm with Jim Walcott from Vanity Fair. It's 47 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
MorningsEdition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Two past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio in our final 3 weeks. That's right. It's gone. Morning's Edition is over. It's done. I will be leaving this show, and the show will no longer exist in the mornings. Mark Riley will be back next week. He's taking a week off when he can because he's got to get ready for his new position here from 5 to 7 in the morning. We'll be Mark Riley from 7 to 9. We'll be Rachel Maddow. I don't know what the names of those shows will be called. I don't know much about the structure of those shows, but they will not be Morning Sedition. Morning Sedition is no more. The characters and comedy bits that you've grown to love over the last year and a half will be gone. I am in negotiations with Air America to maybe do a show in the evenings out of Los Angeles and perhaps on the weekends here in New York. Perhaps we can bring back some of those characters and some of the comedy if that show manifests itself. If not, I'm sure I will show up somewhere else. I certainly appreciate all of your support, all the petitions, and all the emails. We're extremely touching and incredibly important in the fight to try to save this show, though it was not successful. If you go to markmaron.com, you can sign up for my mailing list, so no matter where I turn up, I can tell you what I'm doing. We're going to continue our conversation with Jim Walcott in just a second, but we know things are tough in the job market right now, so we've decided to help out. We scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our Morning's Edition Monday job listing. It looks like somebody in the Bush administration is finally facing up to reality. Experienced? Let me wait till the dwarves finish. Experienced liquidators needed. Major enterprise based in Washington, D.C. seeks individuals to dismantle and sell off inventory associated with a failed venture. Among the items that must go are neocon schemes for American hegemony in the Middle East, a militarily enforced Pax Americana, an imperial presidency, and plans for a permanent Republican majority. Most of the leftover items are unused and indeed even untested. Many can be peddled at bargain prices to right-wing think tanks and ideologues, but as we discovered, you will be hard-pressed to sell them to the American public. Anything that can be salvaged should be carefully repackaged to look like something it's not. Interested parties should meet behind 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the dead of night. Please bring your own shovel. All right, there you go. We are in conversation as we took a little break there, but we are back with Jim Walcott. He's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and author of Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants, The Looting of the News in a Time of Terror. On the break, we were talking about euthanizing cats and also and about many other things, because we don't have to go into the cat thing. I'll talk about that tomorrow in my confession. But let's talk about the Abramoff investigation, because I read about that over the weekend. It's interesting, the stories that come out over the weekend in the paper, but now Senator Burns out of Montana is being implicated. We've already got Congressman Ney out of Ohio implicated. Mm-hmm. I think DeLay is done with. I think that the waves and repercussions of this investigation could take down a good part of the GOP, certainly in the House of Representatives. What do you think?
Oh, I think so. You know, it's interesting. I have a friend who, I don't want to mention her name, but she was working on a piece months ago about the whole Abramoff thing, and, and she was telling me how far it reached. And I have to say, everything she was talking about 6-8 months ago has really panned out, because it draws in not just elected officials, but of course it brings in Ralph Reed.
Yes.
It drags in Grover Norquist. It drags in all the people you'd like to see pulled down.
Right.
And the thing is, it's so big that no one, that they almost have to chop off pieces of it, because there's no way to get the whole scope of it.
Yeah, if just people that were out and out taking bribes to change, to put things on the congressional record, to mobilize people against certain Indian tribes at the behest of other Indian tribes who were being represented by Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon, who was once the spokesperson for Tom DeLay. There were business trips provided. I mean, this is the way that business is done in Congress in a lot of respects. This is what this has brought down Congress before. But I just hope to God that, I know it's going to be mostly Republicans, but I really hope to God that the corruption of this administration is really taken to task in this thing.
Well, I think we're good. I think we're going to see it. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that this has all been happening sort of under the radar until recently. It's been working, you know, almost as if like a self-cleaning process. It's almost as if, because, you know, it ties in with other things that are going on. And for example, you not only have this, but you have that wonderful investigation that I'm fascinated with, that Patrick Fitzgerald is doing into Hollinger, because Conrad Black, the Canadian newspaper mogul who then gave up his citizenship because he wanted to be Lord Black.
Yeah.
He was one of the major funders of the neocons. I mean, the Hollinger board had, on its board were Richard Pearl, Henry Kissinger, William Buckley. I mean, it was just, like a murderer's row of neocons. And, you know, he's now, and one of the things that we're seeing in all of these things is you get somebody to flip on the higher up. And that's what's happened with Hollinger. The number two guy has flipped on Black. It's happening,
Scanlon. It's like rat out your boss for the better of the country and save your own ass, and then we can all enjoy it.
Yeah.
This stuff is coming down. On the next hour, we are going to talk to Cindy Sheehan. Thank you, Jim Walcott, for being
here.
And we got a big hour planned. Cindy Sheehan, that's enough. Air America Radio, Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. Mark Reilly is out this week, resting up for next week, which will be one of our last 3 weeks on the air here with this particular show. Morning Sedition, folks, the struggle has been lost. We are losing Morning Sedition. I will be gone from this part of the morning. Reilly remains. He will be here from 5 to 7. Rachel Maddow from 7 to 9. I cannot thank you people enough for sending so many thousands of emails, for signing petitions, for making me feel like we actually did something here in terms of making people, getting people through a very dark time after the election. I really appreciate all your support. It was not for nothing, but this show is done. The comedy bits are done. The new morning is going to be what it is. I don't know what those shows are going to be called, but those are two very capable talents, and they're gonna bring you your mornings after December 16th. I'm in negotiations now with Air America to possibly create something in the evenings out of L.A. that I guess will make it over here, maybe in the weekends, maybe late at night. I don't know. We'll see. There are talks underway to get me on the air on Air America out there. No matter what I do, whether I end up somewhere else, go to markmaron.com and go ahead and sign up for my mailing list, and I'll tell you what's going on and where I'm going to be, because there's a lot of possibilities out there. I'm looking forward to connecting with the audience that we created here on Morning Sedition for years to come. And if we stay on Air America, who knows, maybe we'll be able to bring you some of those characters that you've grown to like on our show, and you can hear from them on a daily basis if that works out. We're going to talk to Cindy Sheehan in a few minutes, and I just want to say, over the Thanksgiving weekend, it's just amazing to me she's down there in Crawford, Texas, and the press tries to minimize it. There were 200 protesters that showed up in Crawford on the Saturday after Thanksgiving just to hang out and reflect, show their support for the troops at Camp Casey, and grieve, with Cindy Sheehan, with people who have lost their children in this war. And the press tried to make it seem like it was a non-event, but 200 people on a holiday weekend is not bad. And I tell you, the fact that every time Cindy Sheehan shows up anywhere and there is support means that there is a growing anti-war dialogue among Americans. It's certainly apparent in how people are reacting to this administration and the war. It's certainly apparent in Representative Murtha's outstanding proposal last week to bring the soldiers home, as quickly as possible, and the dialogue that happened after that. I think that Cindy Sheehan started the momentum by changing the nostalgic frame of the anti-war movement and making it personal and heartfelt in a way that is truly patriotic and unique. It is not just this reactionary hippie thing anymore that the right likes to still characterize it as. It's real Americans experiencing real grief and doubt and anger and towards an administration that's dragged us into a war based on lies and a war that's seemingly more and more unwinnable. And everybody that surrounds Bush is seeing that. And the ones that aren't seeing it are being caught in their lies. And the other ones, the representatives and senators, are starting to shift their ideas about how it should be handled. But Bush remains alone, isolated in his non-wavering disposition because of his religious fanaticism and his stubbornness to not be empathetic or sympathetic to the loss of lives. It blows my mind. And there, and now over there in Crawford, there were about a dozen counter protesters down the street in a pro-Bush rally. And I got to be honest with you. You'd have to be pretty ignorant of what is unfolding as truth to support Bush policy at all at this point. The basic principle that pro-war Bushies defend is that the war is bad, but you don't leave until it's done, until the job is done. What is the job exactly? Why are they okay with Americans dying? Is it weapons of mass destruction? No, that was a lie. Is it to install democracy? That's not happening, as the neocon death cult has planned it. Is it to run the taxpayers' money into the pockets of military contractors? Well, if that's the case, well, then if that's worth dying for, then that is happening. Is it to inflame a civil war that would go on whether we were there or not? Oh, that's happening too. Is it to create an Iraqi army that is plagued with tribal differences that cripples its effectiveness? Well, that's happening as well. So if that's worth dying for, then these pro-war people are right. Is it to stand by while an Iraqi police force harboring militias aligned with Shia extremists torture and kill potential innocent Sunnis? Well, that's happening. So if that's worth having our troops die for, then I guess the pro-war people are right in that way. Is it to put our troops out there as targets for terrorist training? Well, that's happening, so if that's something they support, then I guess they're right. Is it to watch over an alignment between religious extremists in Iran and Iraq exchanging bomb-making technology that kills Americans and Iraqis? Well, check, that's going on. So that if that's something that the pro-Bushies are for, then that's also happening. Well, it's very disturbing because these people that are still for this war are so afraid of taking on what they think is an American or what they believe this is a core value, that they stand by their president no matter what, which is just ridiculous. And it's just that they're so frightened that if they don't do that, that they're going to be faced with, their feelings, their confusion, the chaos of having the president mislead us, that they just can't even face that. So they'd rather stubbornly, stand there and be for this war. And there were only 12 of them. That I will minimize, and that I will show that both times that Cindy has been out there, and we'll talk to her. Let's talk to her right now on the phone now from Crawford, Texas. Cindy Sheehan, good morning. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
It's just me, Mark Maron. I'm by myself.
Hi,
Riley.
Mark.
Riley's on vacation. So look,
slacker.
Yeah, it's nice. He's going to take a little break for a week. It's always nice to have a vacation. But Cindy, so you're out there, and I'm reading these news reports, and they're trying to trivialize the fact. But you had on Saturday after Thanksgiving, you had a couple hundred people there.
We had over 500 people come in and out that day.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, how could they do that?
Yeah, I think so, too. I think it's really amazing.
How could they make that seem like it's nothing? I'll tell you what is nothing. There was only a handful of pro-war supporters down the street.
Right, so there was, like to call them the killing and killer supporters.
Exactly. And were there any problems over the weekend?
No, not at all.
So there was
not really. We had, the Secret Service kept close tabs on us, and we're a threat. We're not a physical threat to the president. what we are is we're a threat to his
His policy, his ideology.
His policies, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you know, they just kept really close tab on us. And I don't think they kept close tabs on the killer supporters down the road.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I can't believe the audacity of this guy down the street, one of the main guys, is trying to recommend legislation to ban anyone from the media from using fallen soldiers' names or pictures without family permission. I mean, who do they think they are? I mean, this is the country's responsibility. This country got us into this war. So
exactly.
In terms of you know, who can have a debate about what, you know, why those soldiers are dying, if we have a problem with it, then we should absolutely speak out. The idea that he's trying to legislate against that just shows the denial and sad insanity of those people.
Well, you're right. You know, it's not fair that only, you know, really a handful of families in this country have to sacrifice anything or pay any price for his murderous policies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do at Camp Casey, is show, you know, America that there's some people who are paying a devastating price for his policies. Show the faces of the soldiers. Let people know that they're not numbers, that they're living, breathing human beings. And if they don't have anything to worry about, if their policies are defensible, then let them defend their policies.
Was anyone arrested over the weekend?
We had 12 people arrested on Wednesday for trying to camp at our first Camp Casey, where camping and parking have been banned by the Board of Supervisors. And they were sleeping in the ditches, or they were camping in the ditches, and they were arrested for obstructing traffic. So what they were really arrested for was exercising their First Amendment rights.
Yeah. Now, what was it? They tried to change the law because of your presence there last time, and this was a repercussion from that?
Yes, exactly. And we're challenging that law on the constitutionality of it, because we weren't camping in the roads. We weren't obstructing traffic. You know, they were in the ditch out, you know, away from the traffic. So what this country is doing is, you know, just trying to stifle all forms of free speech and any kind of dissent against George Bush and his murderous policies.
Well, I was reading about something you did that I found, you know, incredibly moving. Now, you on Saturday, was it, where you held up a picture, the one existing picture of military coffins?
Right, that Casey is in one of those coffins,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what did you say?
I said, this is George Bush's exit strategy.
that's very powerful, and
yeah.
It's almost satirical. It's unbelievable. That's a powerful statement. You also said that you want our kids to walk off planes.
Exactly. Not be loaded off in the United loading dock like Casey was.
Yeah. Well.
And,
you know,
if I'm wrong for that, and if I'm some kind of monster because I want our troops to come home alive, I'll be that monster, because I really think what we're doing is having an effect, and I think they will come home now. And before, they never planned on letting our guys come home, who are on their third and fourth tour of duties right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think you're a monster at all, and I think that, you know, a good two-thirds of this country doesn't. You're still looking at a very small percentage.
Absolutely.
that are demonizing you, Cindy. And I was talking about it earlier today. I think you've redefined the anti-war movement, and the cultural impact of what you started is now you're seeing the rewards of it, because the debate has been effectively promoted, you know, it's been put out there into the culture, and people are now starting to question all of it.
And that's amazing to me, and that's a Camp Casey miracle, and we're so grateful for that. And we're going to keep on going.
Anything,
you know,
people can do?
We're not going to stop. We just don't work when we're out there in Crawford. You know, we're in the trenches every day trying to stop this war.
Anything? And how can people get involved? Anything people can do right now?
They can. What we're doing now is trying to get everybody to start Camp Casey's, you know, at their congresspeople's offices, the ones who are pro-war, pro-killing.
Oh, that's good.
You know, there's several all over the country on Fridays. You know, there's Schumer's and Hillary's offices in New York, Bailey Hutchinson's office in Dallas, and, you know, go down there every Friday and just, you know, put pressure on them to join with the rest of America, get in line with us, start bringing our troops home.
Thank you so much for joining us, Cindy. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Mark. Nice talking to you, too.
Take it easy. That was Cindy Sheehan from Crawford, Texas, with a little bit of activism that you can engage in with yourself or your friends to get your representatives, whether they be Democrat or Republican, to get into the dialogue of getting our troops home. That's the way that we can best support them. It's 18 past the hour. We got the Slander Minute coming up, so stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Living on the road, my friend. What's gonna keep you free and clean? Now you wear your skin like iron and your breath's as hard as kerosene.
23 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. Riley's on vacation. You're listening to Townes Van Zandt, man. Heavy Cat. Margaret Brown, the director of Be Here to Love Me, a documentary about Townes Van Zandt, is going to be in the studio in about 10, 12 minutes, and we're going to talk to her about it. I just watched it. I had to take 2 days to watch it. It's so heavy. The dude was one sad dude, but wrote some great songs. As I've mentioned here at some point, my contract with Air America Radio is running out, and I'll likely head to Los Angeles soon. It's a sad story, but we thought we could spice it up, maybe tweak it a little on today's Morning Sedition Slander Minute. Here now, our slander correspondent, Ted Fields. Ted, what can you add to this story?
Well, Mark, I've spoken with reliable sources, and I've learned that Mark Maron is leaving Morning Sedition because he's fallen off the wagon again.
Wait, whoa.
Apparently, he snorted crushed diet pills the whole time he interviewed Chris Elliott.
What?
Mark Maron has isolated himself so much, only three people talk to him on a daily basis now. His wife, Mishnah, usually calls to say he's failed her. Mark Riley talks to him, of course, but only on the air.
Oh, no.
And featured player Jim Merle calls once a day to ask if he has any job leads.
Ted, those are lies.
I don't think so.
They're lies.
I don't think so. I'm reading it right here, see? I've written it in pen, so it's true.
But wait, I'm Mark Maron, and I'm the subject of the story, so I know.
Who am I going to believe, Mark? You or my sources?
Me, Ted.
Wrong. And if you're wrong about that, how can I believe you on anything else?
What?
My sources also say Maron doesn't have to leave the show. They said management begged him to stay.
Oh, wait a
but
minute.
But he demanded luxuries like a... Well, what does it say here? He demanded luxuries like a phone.
Now, come on. I did not demand my own phone from Air America. I mean, I'm not crazy.
I'm just saying what my sources said.
Oh, come on.
My sources also say Mark Maron is off work today because he's in jail.
Ted, I'm sitting right here in front of you.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that.
What do you... This has been the Morning Sedition Slander Minute.
Apparently, Mark Maron chained a baby to a toilet.
With slander correspondent Ted Fields. Thank you, Ted. I really appreciate that.
You know, before we started the bit, Jim Earl asked me if it was okay if he sat in and made fart sounds through Barry's entire bit.
What's that?
Jim Earl wanted to sit in here and make fart sounds during your bit.
I said, is that going to be okay with Barry? He said, well, we go back to high school together, so.
Yeah, he could have done that.
That's what
I've known him long enough that I sort of unconsciously work everything I write around assuming Jim is somewhere nearby making fart
sounds. You hear fart sounds in your writing while you're writing it.
Somewhere nearby to create an obstacle for you, huh?
Yeah,
Barry?
Something like that. Just,
hey, Barry.
All right, let's start the whole thing again.
This is
Mark has apparently...
Hey, Barry, you suck.
So this is the beginning of what was known as the comedy team of Lank and Earl, ladies
and
gentlemen.
No, my friend, this is the end. What you're looking at right here.
Hey, Barry.
Yes, Jim.
All right. You know, Jim, Barry and I were just speaking in a relatively modern Jewish dialect. It was the, I ate too much over Thanksgiving. I can't.
Oh, no. Do you ever stop eating? No, I never stop eating. I got to chew something.
It's Brendan McDonald's 26th birthday today.
Really?
Happy birthday, man.
Oh, my God.
And Kalo somehow arranged City Bakery. We brought in a bag of the damn butter rolls. And here I'm sweating butter from 3 days of turkey and stuffing and potatoes. You know, what really pisses me off is I live with anorexics. You know, I have crazy people in my family.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about Brendan.
No, I'm not going to mention names, but I'm down there at Thanksgiving. She's like, what do we got to use real sugar for? It's like it's one day a year we can use real sugar. Not just a little sugar, but butter and sugar. And it went on for 3 days. I'm sweating butter. So Kayla brings in these to celebrate Brendan's birthday, which I already ate.
It was, by the way, it was a birthday pastry for Brendan, and Marin just ate it.
So wait a minute, there's no birthday pastry left for Brendan?
No, he bought a bag of them. Oh, didn't okay. you?
Yeah, but he presented sure. that one to me on a plate.
Yeah, exactly. but it's sitting here in the studio, man. What do you want from it? It's not a pastry, it's a butter sponge.
You can't leave food in front of a Jew. Right, what are you thinking?
You can cry all the fat out with the Towns Van Zandt lady.
Okay. Whoa. It's a flour butter sponge. What, Jim? What?
It's 27 past the hour, Mark.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks. Towns Van Zandt, the second we talk about
I'll be
it.
Glad when I'm done with him.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hey, folks, it's 34 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. Mark Riley is out for the week. That sound you hear is Towns Van Zandt. Towns Van Zandt never meant to live long, but he certainly lived longer than anyone imagined, and he left a legacy that will last far into the future. Our next guest is the director of Be Here to Love Me, a film about Towns Van Zandt that releases this coming Friday at the Angelica Cinema here in New York. Margaret Brown joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no problem.
It's nice to see you. I'm not unlike a lot of people, I was introduced to Towns Van Zandt probably a few years ago. I'd heard his name, but I didn't really know his music. And then somebody said, you got to listen to this guy. He's a genius. He's one of the best songwriters ever. And then I listened to him, and it still didn't quite click with me. And then I listened to him again, and I kind of forced myself to continue to listen to him to hear the depth of his songs. And I realized the reason, after seeing your film, the reason why I had a hard time connecting to him was I think that his sadness was almost too great for me to personally bear at that time. But after seeing your film, I'm going to revisit it again and again. And if nobody knows who Towns Van Zandt is, you should definitely see this film. You should definitely pick up some of his music. So what is it about Towns that really drew you to make the film?
Well, my roommate, when I was living in New York before I moved to Austin, he played a record for me, and I think it was a moment in my life when I was really receptive to what Towns's music and the sort of depth and melancholy of it. It just hit me really strong. It really stood out. He was playing a lot of different records. We were kind of having a record playing contest, like who could play the coolest record.
Yeah.
And the other person hadn't heard.
Yeah,
and and he played the Towns record. It just got me.
It just grabbed you right away.
Yeah, a really profound way. And I just went out and bought everything. It wasn't like I was thinking about making a film. That came later after I started hearing a lot of really intense stories about him in Austin.
Yeah. That's why I do that same thing, though, and I'm about to do that with Towns Van Zandt, because all I have is his greatest hits thing.
Yeah.
And I do that with anybody, and I also play that game with people. I have the secret song that will make you think that I'm a genius.
Yeah.
But now I have to go out and buy the original records, because all I have is his greatest hits thing.
Yeah.
But I think what Towns does is he just, like, you can feel it. He leans on your heart. I mean, a lot
That's
of people
really
don't.
Good way to put it.
Oh yeah. I can't describe it any other way. But I just want to clear some up for our audience is that he's a well-known guy, and not just in Texas but around the world. And he influenced a lot of people. A lot of people in Texas, and you show this in your movie, just really credited him. That's the one thing I learned from the movie that I didn't know, is that he was part of that whole singer-songwriter community that came out of Texas, but he was the one that everyone thought was a genius, but never quite surfaced like the rest of them.
Right.
Like Joe Ely, and who are some of the other ones?
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Dale Gilmore.
Yeah, right.
And although he's not in the film. And, I mean, Willie Nelson is in the film. Emmylou Harris.
Chris Christopherson.
Lyle Lovett.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people.
What was Jimmy Dale Gilmore's band's name?
The Flatlanders.
Oh, the
band.
Flatlanders,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so now... In terms of Towns and his personality and the people you talk to about him, how would you describe his personality, really?
I mean, it's a pretty complex thing, and we were kind of talking about it before we went on the air. I mean, I mean, I think he had a really magnetic personality. One thing Guy Clark said to me before we made the movie.
He's another musician, like his old buddy. That guy's hilarious.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. He said, you have to make sure you make it funny. So many people focus on the depressive qualities in the music, but he was like the funniest guy I've ever met. And I feel like the film, you know, balances that, the humor and also the deep sadness, which I think Towns thought was, you know, that's
the way life is.
Yeah.
That I'm the same way. And a lot of people can't really handle that. They can't handle the unadulterated sadness that is life. They can't live in it, you know. And this is a guy that lived in it, and he knew he was living in it, and he chose to live in it. That was the fascinating thing about the film as well, is that he was committed to his music in encapsulating what he thought. He wanted to make, you know, diamonds out of songs. He wanted to make perfect songs. That his whole life was about that, to the point where he didn't have a life. He sacrificed everything. He sort of pushed
his life as the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he didn't make a lot of money, and that didn't seem to bother him. And when his songs became hits through Emmylou Harris and through Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard, he seemed sort of nonplussed about it. Kind of like, I guess that's good. But I mean, it's really important. It's just the song, man.
Well, I think he thought it was important not to get influenced by that and not to have that become your life, like fame or success or making a lot of money. He wanted to stay true to his roots. I think he was afraid he would lose what he had if he let go of that close connection to just, you know, what he was writing about.
Mm-hmm. The thing that fascinated me, too, about the film is this is a guy that grew up in Texas that had, you know, he was sort of a jock in high school. And then all of a sudden his life changed when he figured out he could sniff glue. And then apparently he was just, out of control. And the sad thing is that his parents put him into a mental institution and gave him electroshock, which you think changed him irreparably or helped him?
The electroshock erased his memory of childhood. He couldn't remember his childhood people, and it's all is in the film. But,
sure.
His first wife said the only way he could remember his childhood was by stories people told him about it. So it was gone. And so I feel like, in a way, those songs that he wrote were an attempt to replace the memories, you know.
And also it seems that there's something poetic about being detached from all the clutter of your childhood memories and just dealing with the sadness. Because you do sense that when you listen to his music, that there is some sort of void there. There's something that he's right at the edge of that is like that existential nothingness that he is sort of, you know, moving around. It's very profound. It's a very profound experience to watch the movie and listen to the music. And you talk to his kids. How many sets of kids does he have?
Sets of kids. Well, his third wife Janine had two kids with him, and his first wife Fran had one kid with him. And there's actually another kid that's not in the film.
Yeah.
A young lady who lives in Arkansas.
She didn't want to be in the film?
I didn't even know about her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it with another woman or?
With another woman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, is there, I know that Willie Nelson and all these guys respect him. They recorded their music. Is there an estate? Is there money being made for these kids?
I think so. I mean, there's been a lot of songs and I mean, of course, since he's died, I think he's gotten a lot more famous, and a lot of people are recording his stuff. And a lot of bands like Mudhoney has done some of his songs.
I love Mudhoney.
Yeah.
Mudhoney, wild. I met that guy up in Seattle. Uh-huh. He's Mark Arm. He's a singer, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't met him.
That's amazing, because that band, they're another like band that is deeply into a dark place in some respect. But they invented grunge, and not unlike Towns Van Zandt, their genius was co-opted by bands that became more successful with it. And I don't know if it bothers them or not, but it really didn't seem to bother Towns.
I don't think so.
Now, what about, let's talk about Steve Earle, because Steve Earle does a show on this network. I believe he's still doing a show, and he hangs out occasionally. He's a good cat, and he seemed to be one of those guys that everybody seems to have a Towns Van Zandt story. And it's sort of, it's interesting with guys like him to figure out what is being mythologized. Because it's Joe Ely, right? Was the guy in the bar telling the story about seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that story almost sounded like the beginning of a creation myth about Towns Van Zandt.
Yeah, it is, you know, the creation myth, I think.
Right, where he's just like, I just saw this guy wandering along the side of the road with two boxes of records. Now, is that true? Did you question?
Yeah, that's true. No, that story is true. That's a famous Texas songwriter story, you know, that's the story.
Does that mean it's true, or is that could that be
true.
The myth?
I mean, yeah, I think it's true. I think that's one of the only stories in the film that's true.
The one that Steve Earle told was insane.
Yeah.
It's an insane action of a guy that really is out there and really doesn't consider life to be that important. Can you tell that story that Steve Earle told?
Steve Earle was visiting Towns where he lived outside of Nashville, and he lived in this really secluded place on the
cabin. In a trailer. Oh, that was the cabin,
in the cabin,
right?
Yeah, in Nashville. That was later. And I think Steve Earle was like walking around the woods with a gun, you know, trying to look cool with the gun.
That's how he describes
it.
He said he was hunting. It was like, I wasn't really hunting. I was just walking through the woods with a gun trying to look cool.
Yeah. And he came back, and Towns had like a cowboy gun.
Revolver. Yeah. 357 or something.
Yeah. And he basically just played Russian roulette with himself, and he kind of pulled the hammer back like too fast for Steve Earle to like do anything. He thought if he, you know, in any way sort of did anything, it might, you know,
right,
couldn't do anything. It was powerless, and he just had to watch it.
Yeah, he did it. He said that Earle said that he put one bullet in the chamber, spun it around, and did it. He played it with himself three times, and Earle just stood there. And Steve Earle's observation was very interesting. He's like, what kind of person would do that to a friend, put a friend in that position? And he said that the repercussions of it, you know, lasted years, that he could never get it out of his head.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing when you hear the story, you wouldn't think about what it felt like unless you hear him explain it that way. Like, that's really what you would feel. It's like, why would you draw me into your...
Yeah, it was a very personal moment, because when you hear stories like that, you're like, well, man, that dude was out there. He just played Russian roulette, but you don't think about the repercussions of...
Yeah, and a friendship that might be ruined or altered in some way that's not repairable.
Yeah, exactly. And you think about that in terms of the way he lived his life, in terms of how much time he spent on the road, of his alcoholism, of all the unmedicated manic depression, of all the stuff that he dragged all his friends through, that there were friends like Guy Clark who understood that this was a guy that was going to live for his art and he was going to die for his art, and that was the end of it. There's a secret code among people who know the road and people who live in that world, that they're like, well, I don't know who's going to go first, but I love you, brother, that kind of thing. But there's also, when you see his kids, like the first set of kids have a hard time dealing with the way their father behaved, and then the second set of kids seems to be like really reverential and sort of like he was a genius, and I'm really glad I got to know him.
Well, they didn't really know him. I mean, I think they're dealing with the fact that they never knew their father in this way. And JT, the oldest son, really, he knew him. And so he was able to, he's an adult, you know.
Is that guy a musician?
He is a musician. He's a musician, but I think he's, you know, I'm not sure he'll ever just do that.
Right.
He also has a company in Austin that he builds like cabinets and boats out of old growth wood, like reclaimed.
Well, that's nice.
Barns and stuff.
See, I'm going to be looking for a new job here in a few weeks. And
it's a good job. I love
Austin, and Austin is one of the most creative little cities in the world. And it seems like there's a certain. It's one of those places that has its own cliquey kind of artistic community that's been around for a long time, and they all take care of each other. So now, what kind of influence do you think that? You talked about Mudhoney, but when you go out on the road with this film, as you have in Texas and in London, what kind of people come out? Because I know in the film you show this fan club, these letters. His first record producer, I guess, had set up a fan club, and he was just surprised at the type of letters that came in, that these weren't just like, I really like his music, it's groovy, but it was like, this guy saved my life.
Yeah.
So what kind of people are coming out to see you when you go bring the movie out there and speak?
We've shown it all over the world now. It was winter there, but we went to New Zealand and Australia. We've been a lot in Europe. We went down to Argentina and showed it. And I think, I mean, he didn't tour ever in Argentina, but he's toured a lot, and everyone had a town story. He connected with so many people on the road. It was interesting. And a lot of people were, you know, debating things that were in the film that, you know, I don't think it went down that way. They were really personally connected to him. And he made a lot of people would come up to me and just tell me stories of how he, you know, saved them in a bar or pulled them off the floor and said, you know, this isn't the way to go.
I love that, because I came up in the stand-up comedy world, and there's a couple of cats that I knew that were willing to risk their lives to do what they do, to have that life, to live on the road, to become that myth, to dedicate themselves to their creativity in a way that could end their lives. And they're unique. There's not a lot of them willing to do that.
I'm not sure that that's what you have to do, though. I mean, that's one thing I think I came out of the film, because I think I had a really romantic idea about that kind of self-sacrifice, which I think is also a male thing. I don't think...
It's a rock and roll myth.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that that's the way to go always. And I'm not even sure that if Towns hadn't had the shock therapy, or if he hadn't been such an alcoholic, that...
he would have kept going and maybe produced more music, and if he had better management.
Steve. I mean, Steve Earle, you know, I think a lot of those people who've had a really hard time, you know, they would argue that you definitely don't have to go that way. Like, they didn't end up.
Well, it also becomes an argument. Once somebody dies, and if somebody maintains
solidifies.
Right. If somebody maintains their integrity throughout that entire journey,
mm-hmm.
and it seems clear to me that they all knew he was willing to die, and that they all knew that there
That Russian roulette story, I mean, Steve Earle was not the only person. A lot of people I interviewed would say, there's a lot of guns around, you know.
Sure.
And I think that was always this thing, if he would sort of dare people to play with him.
Well, that's crazy. The thing. It's like it's very selfish.
Yeah,
it's a selfish way of life, and it's very damaging to a lot of people. But if you die before you get too sad, you know, you will be mythologized if you've made some sort of contribution. But I agree with you. I think that you can be a responsible artist and can prolong your life and still do great work by taking care of yourself. The weird thing is that, as I said before, when somebody dies, then that's it. That's all you have.
And also, I don't think for Towns he was thinking about it. It wasn't like this conscious choice, like, I'm going to go that way. It was more just like the way he went. Like,
well, he died of alcoholism, basically.
Pretty much,
congestive heart failure, right?
Yeah, heart failure.
Yeah, that's pretty common with late stage alcoholism. But it is a great movie. It's a sad movie. But it is a portrait of a guy who is one of America's great songwriters that a lot of people don't know about. And it does show the toll that living that life takes on you, and it takes on other people. And then you can decide for yourself whether you think it was worth it or not. Thanks, Margaret Brown.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming. We'll be back with the Liberal Agenda. Stay with us. It's 49 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Terry Jones from Monty Python, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition. They're not the Messiah, they're very naughty boys on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley out for the week, taking a vacation before the big week, big work starts from Mark Riley. I've been telling people this morning, Morning Sedition is no more. It's over. We lost the fight. All your emails were very powerful and very moving, and did have an impact on the executives in charge of this decision. They are offering me a show in Los Angeles, an evening show at night, maybe some time here on the weekend. You know, we'll try and make that happen. We're in negotiations now. We'll see what we come up with. But no matter where I end up, markmaron.com, if you want to get on my mailing list, is the place to go. And I was just thinking about, we were talking to Margaret Brown in here about her film, about Towns Van Zandt, Be Here to Love Me. Yeah, you know, I have to be grateful. It is Thanksgiving, and you know, even now I'm getting emails that are incredibly encouraging. And that, you know, I don't live the life of a freak. I'm not strung out on drugs or alcohol because I think it's a rock and roll way of life. It's a tremendous risk to live that life. I tell you, working here at Air America has really elevated my consciousness in terms of, you know, what needs to be done and how to behave. As an activist and as somebody who is concerned about the country they live in, you know, hopefully I'll have an opportunity to do that more in the future. And also, I want to say that I hope you all had a nice Thanksgiving, and I hope that you bonded with your families. I tried to bond with mine. I think we did a pretty good job. I don't see them enough, and I got really fat, which is really what it's all about with me. It's about the fat. Brendan McDonald. I don't want to be selfish, but Brendan McDonald is a guy. It's his birthday today. He brought a cupcake in, and then someone brought a Danish in, and now I'm filled with butter again. But you don't get fat. You're one of those people that just, you know, people must have hated you throughout your life, people like me who can't eat whatever they want.
I get that little gasp.
No, you're like,
you know, it looks like an Ethiopian sometimes.
You're a rail. You're a rail.
That's true. No, I don't dispute that. But, it, you know, you get that distended. It's like a Grover. Oh, like you look like Grover from Sesame Street.
Get a little gas. Look at this. This is fat coming. You
yeah,
see the
yeah.
fat?
You're a woman, man. I got to tell you.
Yeah, my trainer said that, too.
No offense to women, but that's you're wrapped up with the self-image, much like...
It's not the self-image. It's discomfort. I don't care what I look like. It's the feeling. It's something my mother did, and I'm trying to get past it.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, Mom. Now it's time for the liberal agenda. Here's the facts from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for this week. Go to a busy department store, and as you pass by the long checkout line, loudly announce, "Look at me, it's the holiday season, and I'm not buying anything." 2, read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas to your child's second grade class. Casually point out that Santa's sleigh is a gas-efficient hybrid vehicle.
That's true.
3, include a Rockette tribute to Cindy Sheehan in this year's Radio City Music's Christmas show. 4, answer one of those emails you keep getting from Nigeria offering you $40 million if you'll just give them your bank account number. Sure, it's a con job, but they're Africans. You should help them. All right, 5, go to the mall. Instead of Christmas shopping, look at a gift in someone else's basket and sneer, "Does anybody really need one of those?" Here's your phrase of the day. Just drop it in the conversation. So New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson lied that he was chosen by a Major League Baseball team. Wake up, sheeple. George Bush lied that he was chosen by God. There you go. I'll be back tomorrow. Who do I got on my show tomorrow?
We got Mick Ware here tomorrow.
Oh, Mick Ware, one of my favorite
and
guests.
And Lawrence Korb.
Oh, Larry Korb.
And Sam Lipsyte.
And well, big news
plus
tomorrow.
Plus more of the best of Morning Sedition. Lots of highlights and clips.
Thanks, Brendan.
All right.